you can throw that slide up for me, I would appreciate that. We didn't run camp last summer. We kind of took a summer off, but we have decided that we wanted to run camp this summer again. We're going to run it very differently than what we have done in the past. So in case you don't know, we have run summer camp for about 13 years. And we ran two summer camps. They're full days from 9 till about 3. And we had very structured, very organized, and it was a fantastic journey. And we really enjoyed it over the years. Last summer, due to circumstances and due to our move and stuff, we stopped it. And I was gently, I'm going to say that, yeah, I think it's true, gently challenged by at least one or two individuals, why aren't we doing something again this year? And so we are going to do something this year. It'll be at the end of August. We're going to run a half-day camp, and we're calling it, because we don't have it fully together yet. Tomorrow night we're getting together to plan all those details, but the initial impetus was to do something called a science camp. We want to do a different structure. We want to be more of an education-based camp, and so we're thinking about stuff in the area of science, just because we want to blow things up, and we know kids want to blow things up, and we're thinking of something maybe in the area of math, something maybe in the area of literacy, something in the area of sports on the field, and of course we're still going to do a chapel as a part of it. And I've said this to you many times before, when I think about the themes for camp, I preach to you guys my themes. So that's what you guys are going to get today. As I was thinking about the scientific process, and I'm not a scientist by any means or stretch of the imagination, but there is a bit of a process to the scientific method, and I think the beginning of any scientific method is this thing I call curiosity. And so I want to focus this morning on that subject of curiosity, on the topic of curiosity, and pull an example out of scripture that I want to share with the kids this summer. But as I kind of wrapped my own brain around it, I kind of did some more research on this. So finish the phrase for me. Curiosity. Everybody knows that one, right? Curiosity killed the cat. And what we mean by that phrase is that curiosity, generally speaking, is not a good thing. So that's, I think the cat has nine lives might come out of that as well. But we know that, according to that little statement, don't pursue curiosity because it's dangerous. Don't pursue curiosity because it may take you down paths or into areas that is just not appropriate and not good for you. And in fact, as I was doing some research even on this passage I'm looking at today, a lot of theologians really seem to follow that line, that curiosity really has been discouraged a lot. Don't ask too many questions. Don't go down areas that you don't know about because you might come into danger. You might be enticed and pulled into areas that you don't want to go. I beg to differ. Did you know that that line, curiosity killed the cat, is only one half of two phrases? Does anybody know what the second half of the phrase is? Thank you, yes. So curiosity killed the cat, but satisfaction brought it back. And I think what it's saying is, yeah, there is a risk to pursuing curiosity, but the lesson learned, the discovery made, is worth the effort, is worth the risk. So here's my question to you very simply. Do you think of yourself as curious? What do you wonder about? To quote Albert Einstein, he says, the important thing is to never stop questioning. Never lose a holy curiosity. In this time and place, what inclines you to remain curious? What gets you to keep on investigating? What makes you keep listening? Do you still have some curiosity? I probably suggest that we're losing the sense of curiosity, and especially in this age of infant knowledge and access to information that we have on the internet, right? Years ago, when I was still in seminary, Ron Mayforth, one of my professors, he challenged us as young theology students. He said, every year you should pursue something outside your realm of comfort, outside of theology, something outside of just what you would normally do. Take a year and study photography. Take a year and audit a class on something that you would never do. Pursue a hobby. Do something different. Every year, just do something outside of what's normal, because that is how you continue to grow. And I've never forgotten that. Got to say, there's many years I didn't do anything like that. But we currently live in a culture that is infinite access to information of any kind. No longer do we need to go find that book in that library to answer a question or attend a class taught on a subject. All we need to do today is Google it. Yes, Google is a verb. All you need to do is Google it. Just look it up. And yeah, the wealth of information that's gained by that, there is a sense of curiosity, at least at the beginning. But let me just sidebar for a little bit here, for a second, and suggest two ways that I think we're losing our curiosity. And the first way is something called confirmation bias. Did you know that Google is a very smart animal? And then when I research and I do my questions and my searches on Google, Google tailors its searches according to my preferences. And as I do it long enough and long enough, Google will filter out and they'll block stuff that will be on the opposite side of any topic that I'm researching. I think you know that. If you don't, well, you should be aware of that. The downside of that is I'm really not that curious at all. And if I continue to, I think I'm researching, but to find the other side of the story, I actually have to be very, very intentional. I have to intentionally search the other side, which leads to my second hindrance when it comes to this thing called curiosity and this thing called hurry. Hurry is kind of the enemy of a lot of stuff, but certainly of curiosity. Because for me, if I'm in my Google searching and I want to search this certain topic, I don't want to take the time to investigate something else, to look on the other side, because that takes time, it takes effort. Curiosity demands a sense of white space. It demands a sense of you have to slow down long enough to ask the question, to look beyond the surface, to inquire about something. And I want to suggest today that curiosity has a potential to make life richer and deeper and more satisfying. And if that is indeed true, then I have to ask myself, what am I currently interested in? What am I curious about? Which leads me to the curiosity of Zacchaeus. If you want to look it up, I'm going to be in Luke chapter 19, verses 1 to 10. Let me read that for us. Luke chapter 19, verses 1 to 10. I know this is a very, very, very familiar story. Verse 1, Jesus entered Jericho and was passing through. A man was there by the name of Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was wealthy. He wanted to see who Jesus was, but because he was short, he could not see over the crowd. So he ran ahead and climbed a sycamore fig tree to see him, since Jesus was coming that way. When Jesus reached the spot, he looked up and said to him, Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay in your house today. So he came down at once and welcomed him gladly. All the people saw this and began to mutter, he has gone to be the guest of a sinner. But Zacchaeus stood up and said to the Lord, look, here and now I give half of my possessions to the poor, and if I've cheated anyone out of anything, I will pay back four times the amount. Jesus said to him, today salvation has come to this house, because this man too is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek and to save that which is lost. Zacchaeus was seeking to see who Jesus was, but on account of the crowd, he could not see because he was small in stature. So I kind of understand the setting. Jesus was coming to Jericho on a certain day. This is a time he's been in his ministry for a number of years. This is toward the end of his road. Part of the context, Jesus was steadfastly set toward Jerusalem, and he had to go through Jericho to get to his destination. Jesus was becoming popular. People were interested in him. They were curious about him. And again, this man Zacchaeus was also interested, but he was vertically challenged. We're told a couple things about him, right? He was a tax collector, chief tax collector. He was wealthy, but he was vertically challenged. He was curious. He was seeking to see who this Jesus was. He had some questions. He couldn't just go into the crowd because the streets were full. And as a shorter man, to see through, it was a challenge for him. And we kind of say, well, again, in our culture, maybe we would make way for him. I mean, why would you have a difficulty? And I was thinking about this for a minute, and here's what I'm thinking. Why the people were so against him. Zacchaeus was the face of everything that was wrong with the Roman tax system. He was the face of that. Everything that you hated and you struggled and you wrestled with this unfair taxation system, he was the face of that. So when you meet him in public, he was one not looked up upon. Not only was he short in stature, so not only did you physically look down on this man, but in terms of societal stature, in terms of everything that you dislike, this was the face. It's like, imagine you have to phone ICBC to get a claim settled. And that person that you're yelling at on the other end of the line is somebody's mom or father or husband or wife or child. We don't necessarily think of that as we're arguing my claim. And you could talk to Rogers, you could talk to Tellus, talk to Shaw, anybody that we claim. That person on the other end, that's just not a person to us. It's they represent. And so Zacchaeus represented everything that they disliked. He could not. The crowd held him back because of his stature. And so he does the unthinkable. He's persistent. And because he was short, a lot of commentators suggest that they call this little man syndrome, and I don't know if I would give it as much as they do, but some suggest that he's learned how to be very, very devious in his trade, and because in his whole growing up, he's learned how to work around his quote-unquote disability. And so he says, I'm going to be persistent. And so he runs ahead of the crowd, and he finds a sycamore tree, and he wants to climb up into it. And again, just allow your imagination to just play with this a little bit. Think about it. Grown men do not run unless you're into physical fitness. In our culture, seeing grown men run, unless you're wearing, you know, the proper attire, we don't think much of it. But generally speaking, grown man in a three-piece suit doesn't run. And grown men don't climb trees unless you're an arborist. So just allow your imagination, a wealthy man, a man who everybody would have known, a man with all the pomp and all the wealth that he has, scampering down the tree, down the street, and climbing up a tree. I'd suggest it's probably not a tree like that. That's a tree, I took a picture of that the other day over at Vanier Park. I just really think it's a great tree. You think it'd be easy to hide in a tree like that? I think it'd be very, very simple to hide in a tree like that. Some suggest that the sycamore fig tree that he climbed into was very close to something like that, where he could actually climb up in there and be hidden. And that was his intent. He was curious. I want to see, I have some questions about who this man Jesus is, and the crowd is holding me back. I'm not going to give up. I'm going to run ahead, and I want to get up into that tree. See, Zacchaeus had a holy curiosity. We have to understand there is, of course, an unholy type of curiosity that leads people to do things like gossip and access inappropriate material on the internet. But there's also a good, holy kind of curiosity that seeks to know the truth about God, the truth about ourselves, the truth about life, the truth about eternity. And I would suggest that that is the kind of curiosity that drove Zacchaeus to do the humiliating thing that he did. That was a curiosity that said, I'm just not going to stop at the crowd. I'm going to do something else. I'm going to do something that is going to be very demoralizing in a lot of senses. But there was a holy sense of curiosity. Just set up a little bit the setting. Jericho, the city of Jericho where he was at. Ken Geyer, in his devotional, writes this. I want to quote him. I really like what he writes. He says, "Jericho was surrounded by palms and scented with balsam groves. Dates, palm honey, myrrh, and balsam form a continuous caravan of exports to the east. For the Roman government, it is a lush center of taxation. Plump, ripe, fragrant with revenue. And knee-deep in the harvest are the tax collectors, making sure the proper due is rendered unto Caesar, and in the process, a denarius or two rendered unto themselves." Jericho was a major city. It was in the intersection of two major passageways heading off to Jerusalem and to other trade centers. Jericho was a key place to be, and to go from point A to point B, you had to pass through Jericho. It's like, imagine a big intersection that comes in at Jericho, and right in the middle of that intersection is where the tax man sits. And if you want to go from A to B as a merchant, even as just a regular citizen, you invariably had to encounter the tax man. Secondly, chief tax collector. What is that all about? Well, at public auction, wealthy individuals purchased the right to collect taxes on imports, exports, and goods that merchants transported through a particular region. This meant the highest bidders received the authorization to collect taxes in a specific territory. They then arranged for subcontractors to collect the taxes in various parts of the region, profiting from the receipts that exceeded their bids. The subcontractors would commonly inflate the tax rate and thereby make dishonest gain for themselves. Thus, the tax system in the Roman Empire gave rise to many abuses. And Zacchaeus was a chief tax collector, which meant that he was given the contract for a very lucrative area. Also, the chief contractor could be that he would have had subcontractors under him. So not only would he have benefited from his own taxation setup, but all the guys working under him, under that pyramid scheme, would also feed to him. So again, I come back to what I said earlier. Here is the face of everything that is wrong with the world that you live in. This is the Zacchaeus. This is him. But one more thing to recognize. The Pharisees constantly criticized Jesus for eating with sinners and tax collectors. That phrase happens together numbers of times in the New Testament. Tax collectors were grouped with sinners. So you got to understand that a little bit. Sociologists assigned people to upper, middle, and lower classes. In industrial nations, the middle class is relatively large. In Palestine, in the time of Jesus, we know that the middle class was rather small. It was made of professional people, such as shopkeepers, tradesmen, fishermen, educated people such as the Pharisees and scribes, and being a carpenter and considered a rabbi, Jesus probably would have been in the middle class. Even smaller than the middle class was what was called the upper class. This class included the very wealthy, such as the aristocratic families of the Herods, the high priests, and the rich nobility that owned most of the land. The majority of the people in Palestine belonged to the lower class, known as the poor. All sorts of people belonged to this class, such as orphans and widows, the blind, those who were handicapped, they became beggars. And to this class also belonged the outcasts. One can be an outcast without necessarily being poor economically, and such were the tax collectors and sinners. The sinners, who are grouped with tax collectors, are not just ordinary sinners, however. The Pharisees, along with others, could readily admit that, after all sinners are in need of God's mercy and forgiveness. But sinners associated with tax collectors were kind of in their own class unto their own. These were people who deliberately, persistently transgressed the requirements of the law. These would have included those who would have borrowed money to their fellow neighbors and then charged interest on that, a clear violation against Leviticus 25. Prostitutes, those who made a life out of living against the law of God, those were the sinners that tax collectors would have been classified with. Zacchaeus was one of those guys. Are you getting the sense that here's a guy who has some serious obstacles to overcome in order to see in order to feed his curiosity. Zacchaeus was seeking to see, but on account of the crowd would not let him through for a lot of reasons. We get that now, don't we? But he was persistent. And so he ran ahead, discarded all sense of dignity and self-respect, and scampers up a sycamore fig tree. And he waits. The white space. He waits. Scripture doesn't give us any sense of time here. We don't know how long he waited. Did anybody else see him scamper up that tree? Did anybody else know he was there? And he waited because he knew that eventually Jesus would come this way and pass underneath the tree, and my curiosity would be fed. When Jesus came to the place, he looked up and saw and said to him, "Zacchaeus, hurry down, for today I must stay at your house." Zacchaeus was seeking to see, but he could not see on account of the crowd, so he ran ahead so that he could see. He was curious. He didn't just do a Google search. He didn't just ask a couple people, "Hey, you hear about that Jesus guy? Is it true?" I wanted to see. Jesus, as he came to the place, he looked up and saw. The King James Version actually puts the word "and saw." Most other translations take the word "saw" out, but it's there by implication, right? Jesus looked up and saw and said to him. So what is the result of Zacchaeus' curiosity? Number one, Jesus initiates the meeting. He starts the conversation. If you remember the story just previously in Luke chapter 18, verse 35, Jesus stopped the whole procession because there's a blind man who needed to see him. A blind man who was desperate to see Jesus. And Jesus stops the procession and he deals with the blind man. This is now the second time that Jesus stops the crowd and he calls Zacchaeus out. Jesus initiates the conversation. See, unlike the blind man, Zacchaeus remained silent. I think we can understand why Zacchaeus would want to live a life of seclusion. I think we can understand why he'd want to live a rather private life, and that he'd rather not be noticed because, well, you can imagine what he would be received like. Jesus initiates the conversation. Jesus calls Zacchaeus out. Something unexpected by the tax collector. Why does Jesus do that? Because he came to seek and to save those who are lost. Jesus is proactive. And he stops underneath. Secondly, Jesus looks up and saw by implication. So you can look up into a tree like that, and as we zoomed into the pictures, you can see how much more is inside that tree that you would not have seen when you stood further back. Jesus looked up and saw. The one who touches the untouchable is the one who looks up at one not looked up to. No one else would have looked up to Zacchaeus. Not only because of his stature, but certainly because of his societal position. Nobody would have looked up to him, but Jesus looked up. The chief tax collector, the sinner. See, I'm quite certain that if I'd have been part of that crowd, and if I'd have been there that instant when Jesus calls him out, I would have laughed. I would have hooted and hollered at the situation. I would go, "That deserves him right." You know, that time when ICBC didn't do what I wanted them to do. You want to get even. Ah. I would have laughed at him initially. And I think Zacchaeus would have expected that from me. Jesus doesn't do that. See, at the risk of oversimplification here, I see in Jesus a sense of curiosity as well. I see in him, here's a man who looks, and he knows Zacchaeus is up there. And he stops and goes, "Zacchaeus," calls him out. It's kind of an implied question in there, right? He opens the conversation. Number three, Jesus addresses him by his own name, Zacchaeus. He doesn't call him that tax collector, that guy, that organization, that sinner. Jesus says, Zacchaeus. For all we know, this is the first time the two of them met. Zacchaeus certainly would not have expected somebody to call him by name. See, it reminds me of in John 1:43, when Jesus sees Nathanael. Let me read that for you. The next day, Jesus decided to leave for Galilee. Finding Philip, he said to him, "Follow me." Philip, like Andrew and Peter, was from the town of Bethsaida. Philip found Nathanael and told him, "We found the one Moses wrote about in the law and about whom the prophets also wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." "Nazareth, can anything good come from there?" Nathanael asked. And Philip says, "Come and see." When Jesus saw Nathanael approaching, he said to him, "Here is a true Israelite in whom there's nothing false." And Nathanael says, "How do you know me?" And Jesus answered, "I saw you while you were still under the fig tree before Philip called you." Jesus looked up and saw Zacchaeus. And I think in that, all of Zacchaeus' defenses just kind of fell away. And we recognize quickly that this curiosity that Zacchaeus had contained something much, much deeper. I put the word "I must" in red over there because I think we recognize that this is a divine appointment. This is an appointment that was going to happen, and Jesus said, "This is the day that it's going to happen. I must stay at your house." Zacchaeus' curiosity and persistence were orchestrated by God for this very moment in time. You see, if you look back at the earlier story in Luke chapter 18, where Jesus heals the blind man, there's a lot of parallels between these two stories. Let me just highlight a few of them. See, both of these individuals were blind. Both could not see. The blind man was physically blind, but he knew that there was a spiritual blindness deeper, and he was desperate to see Jesus. And in his desperation, he calls out, and Zacchaeus had a sense of curiosity. He too lacked proper sight. He may not have been fully aware of it. He was blind, but he didn't quite know it. Both of them were thwarted by the crowd. Remember, the blind man kept calling out, and the crowd told him, "Be quiet. Jesus doesn't have time for you." Zacchaeus was thwarted by the crowd as well, but both of them were successful because they were persistent. And they wouldn't be quiet. They wouldn't remain until their curiosity, before their desperation, was satisfied. What's the result? The lost were sought and were saved. Today, this day, Jesus says, salvation has come to this house, this day. The resistance of the crowd would not dissuade him, either Jesus or Zacchaeus. Both of them ignored the crowd. None of them were willing to allow the attitude or the judgment or the criticism of the crowd dissuade them because of this divine appointment. There's a holy curiosity going on here. But look at the transformation. Out of everything that he has left, Zacchaeus offers to refund anything that he has stolen, and he adds a 300% penalty to it. I found this very curious. In that line where he says, "And if I cheated anybody," that's not a question. He's going, it's a statement. If I cheated you, I will pay you back four times. See, if you look at the law, required no more than the original amount plus 20% for extortion, according to Leviticus 6:5 and Numbers 5:7. Only for rustlers was a fourfold restitution required, according to Exodus 22:1. Zacchaeus considers himself as bad as a rustler, which is bad in an agrarian culture. And he offers to pay back 300% of what he had stolen from people. Again, if you parallel this with the story of the blind man that just happened, the blind man is restored so that he can get up from being a beggar and he can engage profitably into society and gain money on that level. Zacchaeus, on the other hand, empties himself, becomes like a beggar, gives it all away so that he can follow the Christ that just saved him. Today, salvation has come to this house. So what? Great curiosity. What do we do with this? When engaging in difficult conversations or about to encounter a confrontation, the number one rule is this: do not assume bad intent or ill motives. Do not assume bad intent or ill motives. I think part of this story, you have Zacchaeus, who has been ostracized on every other front, expected hostility. He expected rejection. He had his curiosity about this man named Jesus, but he knew, or he assumed, that in a million years he would never ever be able to just walk up to Jesus and say, "Good day, sir, my name is Zacchaeus, I'd like to know who you are." He may have tried that in that crowd that morning, and the crowd, with their attitude, is saying, hostility, rejection, hostility. Why? Because you're the tax man. You can never change. You cheated me. You robbed me. Everything is wrong with the Roman government. You're just him. And I think Zacchaeus, over the years, would have just assumed that. That everyone had bad intent with him or ill motives. And then he meets this man named Jesus. And Jesus breaks past all of that. Jesus himself, I think, again, has a bit of a sense of curiosity about his demeanor, about his character. And he looks at Zacchaeus and says, "Come on down. I not only want to have a conversation, I want to actually be in your home. I want to visit with you. I want to be right in your world, in your life." And the crowd, how does the crowd respond? They're horrified. He is sitting with him, a tax collector and a sinner. How dare he do that? Why? Because I believe even the crowd never guessed that a guy like Zacchaeus could actually change. I found it curious in my research of this. Some church historians believe that Zacchaeus actually became in the office of a pastor, preacher, minister. He kind of became in charge of some group. And again, I don't know how much truth to this, so I don't want to give too much weight to that. But what I like about it is it shows that there's a life beyond what we see in this story. What's my challenge? It's really quite simple. Stay curious and approach life and people with a teachable attitude. If Jesus can give sight to a blind man, surely he can change the heart of one considered by many as unchangeable. Journey with the Lord, join in on mission, and who knows what sort of discoveries we can make. See, curiosity builds resilience. Remain curious. Become teachable. Be willing to take some risks. Curiosity may have killed a cat or two, but curiosity also brought a few of them back, and they learned something new in the process. Be willing to take some risks, even if those risks may humble us a little bit, especially when it comes to how we interact and receive others, even a guy like Zacchaeus. Do you have an individual like Zacchaeus in your world, in your sphere? What would it take to adopt a sense of curiosity about individuals that you normally would keep at an arm's length? And can we initiate a question, start a conversation, start the first steps of building a friendship? Who would have ever thought that a guy like Zacchaeus was capable of change? Who would ever have considered that his heart could be softened and that his wallet could be opened and that generosity could come from a guy just like him? Maybe we have people like that in our worlds. And maybe in the same way, "I must stay at your house today," Jesus says, maybe there isn't a divine appointment that might be in our path, maybe even as early as today, Stay curious, my friend. Never lose a good, holy curiosity. Be teachable and never know how the Spirit can use our interactions so that salvation may come to that household as well. Let me pray. Dear God, I want to thank you that in your word we hear these simple stories. Zacchaeus is a very simple childhood story. We've heard it many, many times. But there is a deep-seated truth that we all continue to be challenged with. We know it's easy to walk our own lives and our own agendas with a sense of hurriedness and a sense of busyness, but we often don't slow enough to see what's going on around us. Father, I pray that your Spirit would work through each of us who call you as our Lord, that we would try to adopt an attitude and a type of vision that you can give, to see beyond the presenting, to see beyond the surface, to be curious about what lies beneath the surface of those who are in our neighborhoods, in our places of work, those whom we bump into at the shopping mall or just on the street, especially those who are quite different from us. Allow us to be a part of your mission as we go forward this week in our lives. And if a guy like Zacchaeus crosses our paths, may we be willing to slow down enough to see, to inquire what it is you would have us to be, to do.